Hi, I'm Charlie, and this is Stereo Hysteria. Our February Artist of the Month, Wesley Stace, is a singer and songwriter currently based in America, but born in Hastings, who first rose to prominence in the early 90s with a trio of albums on Sire Records under the Dylan-derived pseudonym John Wesley Harding. His skill at writing clever, well-crafted songs, informed by American folk and British pop in equal measure, won him critical acclaim, and his subsequent albums have found him collaborating with such groups as the Jayhawks, the Decemberists, and the Minus Five. He has since dropped John Wesley Harding as a stage name, published 4 highly regarded novels, taught at Princeton and Swarthmore, written reviews and op-eds for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and curated a traveling variety show called Wesley Stace's Cabinet of Wonders. Wes spoke with Stereo Hysteria via telephone last month, and we'll be hearing that conversation over the next hour. But first, we'll hear a song from his 2011 album, The Sound of His Own Voice, which features musical accompaniment by Scott McCoy, Peter Buck, and a quorum of the Decemberists, called Sing Your Own Song.
Long ago, I had a dream. A man came up to me, gave me paper and a pen and a cast iron guarantee. He said, write 6 words and make the next line rhyme and learn 4 basic chords. When you got the 3rd line, well, in next to no time, oh, you'll be wanting more. I didn't want to know about a quid pro quo or why he was picking on me. I guess he didn't know that I was tired of school and bored of poetry. So I played along, stifled a yawn, perhaps he was wrong in the head. And when I woke, I found a note, and this is what it said. You can write your own words, you can sing your own song. And it doesn't really matter if you're out of tune or if no one sings along. You can write your own words, you can make your own rules. And it doesn't really matter how cool you are or what grades you got at school when you sing your own song. So I took the advice and suffice it to say that the rest is mystery. And if anyone out there's nervous or scared, I suggest you listen to me. You can write your own words, you can sing your own song. And it doesn't really matter if you're out of tune or if no one sings along. Cause if you do what you like, and you like what you do, then someone somewhere knows you're there, and the world may come to you when you sing your own song. Now I'm married and I have 2 kids, and we sing songs all the time. My 4-year-old just makes them up sometimes with explanatory mind. And no one's told her that it's difficult yet, that isn't in her head. So we sing her song all evening long and ride until it's time for bed. You can write your own words, you can sing your own song. And it doesn't really matter if you're out of tune or if no one sings along. Cause if you do what you like, and you like what you do, then someone somewhere knows you're there, and the world may come to you. You can write your own words, you can sing your own song. It doesn't really matter. You can write your own words, you can sing your own song.
So you grew up in Sussex in the mid to late 60s?
Yeah, and I was born in 1965.
I would imagine that would have been a really interesting time and place to grow up. There would have been an interesting assortment of music in the air. Do you have any particularly vivid early memories of hearing music?
Well, my mother was a singer and then a singing teacher and was a singing performer. And there was a lot of singing in the house. One of my sisters is a professional singer now to this day and sometimes performs in my Cabinet of Wonders, though that's hardly the most thrilling thing she does. There was a lot of music in the house. Early singles I remember being terribly exciting was Alan Price's version of Simon Smith and the Amazing Dancing Bear, which I got on Decca with one of those blue spiral covered beautiful singles when I was about, I think about three or four. And I mean, considering that was a Randy Newman song, although I didn't know that nor care, it just sounded like a fun children's song to me. Mm. And since that was a Randy Newman song, it's almost like that very first single set the tone for everything that followed. Mm. There was a radio show called Junior Choice that ran on Saturday and Sunday mornings, probably from 7 to 9 or 8 to 10 in the morning. And it would play a mix of all requests, I think, but it would be always a mix of kind of old novelty songs and contemporary songs that were nice for children to listen to as opposed to grown-ups. It was a kids' show on the pop station on Radio 1. I used to listen to that. I got a lot of music off of that. Like, they would have played The Laughing Gnome by David Bowie. They would have played Flanders and Swan, probably, Mud, Mud, Glorious Mud, The Sun Has Got His Hat On, but also contemporary hits. And probably the Alan Price was around that time.
Okay.
So that was a big single for me. And amazing that it turned out to be Randy Newman, which, of course, I didn't discover for another 20 years. In fact, the B-side was Randy Newman as well, a song called Tickle Me.
Mm, okay.
So I reckon Alan Price must have done a whole album of Randy Newman songs at some point.
Mm, like Harry Nilsson.
Exactly, yeah.
I really liked your essay on prog rock in the Yes is the Answer book, and that phrase, if it had curly hair or drawled, you listened, which is such a nice, pithy summation of that post-Dylan generation.
I remember being in a van once in my later career with another singer-songwriter and his band, and I remember it very clearly. We heard Paul Westerberg, you know, then Bob Dylan, then Lou Reed, then Jonathan Richman, then, I know, Alex Chilton. And I think that was a very formative moment for me, because I just went, we just can't listen to any more fucking drawling white guys. That would be so boring if we did that. And it made me kind of just want to listen to anything that wasn't that. You know,
sure.
You'd immediately want to put on Dr. Dre or Gary McFarland or, you know, just anything that wasn't that. But that was also when I was 14 or 15 and discovered Bob Dylan, which happened in a place called the Engine Museum in Brighton, which had a lot of steam engines and stuff in it. My grandma took me. And I don't even think I've ever told the story, but there was a radio playing, 1978. A workman was doing some work. And the radio was playing Baby Stop Crying, which was the single off Street Legal.
Mm-hmm.
And it just freaked me out. I mean, I was 12 or 13. And I just stopped by this door and listened to the whole of the song till it finished. I was like, what? And then afterwards, it was Bob Dylan. And I'd never heard him before. If I had, I hadn't noticed. So I went to get that single the next day. And then I wanted to hear the album. And then I bought Budokan or whatever was the live album. Might have been it then, might have been a bit later. But that was a very, very religious and important moment. And once you've discovered Bob Dylan, you're like, well, that's kind of unattainable because those lyrics are the best things I've ever heard in my life. So maybe I'll listen to other people a bit like him. And so then I got into, like, you know, Phil Oakes and John Prine and Steve Goodman and David Blue and Tim Hardin and Jim Croce and all those kind of people. And what they did seemed a little bit more attainable to me, but just because they wrote such simple little lovely stories, some of them, or I don't know. It just seemed doable. And that was what inspired me to kind of pick up a guitar.
Here's a track from It Happened One Night, a live album released in 1988 as John Wesley Harding's official debut, called Bastard Son.
Just going to tell you about my family. It's a brief story, but Bob Dylan is my father.
Yeah.
John Baez is my mother. And I'm their bastard son. Though my roots show through, I'm just 22. I don't belong to anyone. When the band was disbanded, I was disowned. I got a number you can ring me on, but I ain't got no phone. Got a forwarding address, baby, I ain't got no home. I got no direction home. That's the style of a bastard child. This is the song of a bastard son, yeah. Leonard Cohen, he's my uncle. Uncle Leonard used to make me laugh. Took away my nightmares, tore my daydreams in half. Showed them to me reflected upside down in the mirror that Auntie Suzanne Vega found. Glenn is still doing his tricks today. Only goes to show the growing up might pay. That's the style of a bastard child. This is the song of a bastard son. Well, Bruce and James were family friends. Took my mind to Carolina through the New Jersey bands. Gave me a harmonica when I was three. Nailed a banjo to my knees. Now Bruce is a hero, yeah, James is a slave. Bruce gave in and James just gave up. That's the style of a bastard child. This is the song of a bastard son. I nicked this riff from Bruce Springsteen entirely, actually. Used to be a song called Down, Down, Down. I don't know if you heard that one. Well, my family didn't grow up too well with technology, but I think that this is why they disowned me. But I don't want to be a black sheep getting old. I don't want to be a black sheep, want to get back in the fold. So here's to Leonard, Neil, Warren, Andy, yeah, T-Bone, Dave. You're saying something good, man, it's gotta be saved. That's the style of a bastard child. This is the song of a bastard son. I've only just started playing the guitar, ready to say my has-been. Say my songs are too long, words are too strong, lyrics aren't clean. The synthesizer's broken, the 12-inch does not exist. It's true. It's gonna take me a blessed life to get onto the hit list. Take me a blessed life to get onto the hit list, yeah. But I'm singing for the men, for the women and the kids who grew up like me with seven basic instincts here. That's the style of a bastard child. This is the song of a bastard son. That's the style of a bastard child. This is the song of a bastard son. All right, thanks a lot for listening. You've been great, and I thank you. One more thing to say. Hold on. One more thing. Just want to say one thing before I go. And that is, Bob Dylan is my father, Joan Baez is my mother, and I'm their bastard son. Thanks.
It seems that a lot of your early songs, you explore folk music in this metatextual sense, these wry comments on your place in the folk tradition.
Mm-hmm.
When you started playing out, how were you received by folkies?
Oh, very badly. I've never been received well by folkies, ever. Hmm. And I mean, I have nothing. I consider myself firmly in the folk tradition, except that when I began, it wasn't a tradition, you know, no one would have committed to playing in the folk scene of my kind of age group. People do again now, I think. It's become a lot more hip. And of course, people did throughout the whole thing, but no one was paying attention to anyone playing an acoustic guitar in England. The only person who played an acoustic guitar really in that sense was Billy Bragg, and he played an electric guitar. He just used it like an acoustic guitar. Tracy Chapman, when she was on the Nelson Mandela concert, whenever that was, it was like nobody had seen an acoustic guitar before. Mm-hmm. And she did Fast Car and everybody went, oh, that's what they're for. Oh, you write a song and sing it, you know. But all my influences were those kind of things. But I think that when it came to making a record back then when I was starting out, it just didn't seem like the ambitious or fun thing to do was to be playing solo acoustic guitar. Mm-hmm. You know, like Bob Dylan did in 1961, it seemed like a modern approach was to dress it up a bit more like, well, I don't know why they popped to mind, but Squeeze, you know, who are writing songs with great lyrics and a good tune. And also, I think somebody in my generation, there was, of course, a lot of Bob Dylan and influence of those scrawny white guys, but there was also a lot of ABBA and ELO and David Bowie floating around and Beatles. And that meant that you wanted to put a melody to it as well as going, come gather round, people, wherever you roam. You know, the words of which were so important and so heavy that it needed no tune to get them over, practically. Of course, there is a tune, and it's a brilliant tune, but it's a very simple one. Mm. But in answer to your question, no, the folkies didn't want me going to play at their open mic things particularly. And even now, apart from the Philly Folk Festival, which I've emceed and been the player at a few times, I can't think of another folk festival in the whole of America that's ever booked me in the last 30 years. It's just, I'm not considered part of that world at all. And the fact is, when I started out, I was probably a little abrasive for people playing it folky safe like that. And no, I wasn't doing anything too shocking, but I also wasn't openly cuddly with those people. I found them rather dull, actually. Like, you know, somebody like Suzanne Vega there's much admirable about what she does, but to me, it was just a little too careful and neat and tidy. Mm. And I didn't like that because I was, you know, from a rock and roll world. So despite the fact that I feel folky and have made albums of traditional folk music, what I'm really doing is selling those and playing those for people who've never heard that music before, not for people who've heard it by Richard Thompson and the Carthys and, you know, and all those kind of people.
You studied English literature at Cambridge. When did you make the choice to leave school and pursue music?
Yeah, after I'd finished. I mean, I finished. I'm the poster boy for finishing an education. You know, pointless education. No, I mean, I didn't really get into playing the guitar properly until I went to university when I really had... I mean, I remember I could play Changes by Phil Oakes and Don't Think Twice and quite a few songs by the time I went to university. But 3 years later, it was all I was doing. And it was just because it had given me a terrific amount of time to do it. And there was a social atmosphere at university where you could start a band, you know, do some gigs even. And that's what I did. But in answer to an earlier question, you said a slightly postmodern approach to folk music. And of course, that is a result of self-consciousness about the sincerity of my own applicability or not to be part of that tradition as somebody who was a, you know, middle-class white kid going to Cambridge University. So that would have, I'd have always needed a slightly postmodern approach to pull that off. Although, of course, music proves time and time again that you only are what you tell people you are and they believe that you are. But, you know, it was a great education and it gave me great time to do other things. And I was either going to be a teacher or a novelist or a musician. And I do all those things now. So that's exactly what that education was for.
You've said before that taking on a stage name as a musician was kind of hedging your bets against a career you didn't see as having a lot of sustainability.
That's exactly true. And well put too. It was hedging my bets. It was like, oh, I'm going to go off and do these dates with the Hothouse Flowers. If I do it under a pseudonym, maybe nobody will notice. And if I do have a pseudonym, well, lots of people have pseudonyms. And then I got a record deal and I had a pseudonym and that was that. But I remember people being rather hoity-toity about being called John Wesley Harding. What a bold and brave and stupid thing to do. I didn't think any of those things. I just thought it was one night. You know, it wasn't the result of any great deliberation. I was just like, oh, fuck it, I'll go with John Wesley Harding because my name's Wesley anyway, and they can put that on the poster, and that's the name I'll play under. And then suddenly I had a record deal, and that was that. Like many things in life.
You allegedly auditioned in Seymour Stein's office.
100% true, and most recently delineated by me, if you want to look it up, in the Wall Street Journal, in my review of Seymour Stein's memoir.
Okay.
I wrote the whole story out because they asked me if I'd like to review the book. And I said, look, I have to recuse myself. You know, he signed me. And they said, to my surprise, we know. That's why we'd like you to do it. Because normally, if you know somebody, you shouldn't really review their book, you know. But in this case, they kind of wanted the personal touch on the review. So the review's kind of about that first time that I met him and subsequently what I thought of him and the book and its relevance to that. But yeah, that's true. I had a manager who managed me and another bloke. I mean, here's how things happen. Here's how things work. If you're nowhere and sitting in your room, nothing's going to happen. If you're out there, something might happen. And I agreed to open for this friend of mine. His name was Andy White at the Mean Fiddler. And Andy, for some reason, I can only speculate, probably because he thought my songs were terrible, said to Glenn, our mutual manager, Wes can open three songs, but I don't want him to play any of his own songs. So I was like, okay, fine. I mean, I didn't take that as too much of a... I probably should have done, but... I just, you know, I played Learning the Game by Buddy Holly. A John Hiatt song, but I can't remember which one. God, I mean, I should remember what three songs they were, and I just can't remember. Anyway, so I played three songs that whatever I was considered good. And afterwards, Andy was offered a tour supporting the Hothouse Flowers in the dressing room. The tour wasn't in the dressing room. We were in the dressing room when the conversation happened. And John McIver, the agent for Asgard, said, Andy, do you want to do it? And Andy had just finished a tour with the Hothouse Flowers 6 months before, and I'd gone to see them play in Northampton. And there were literally five people in the audience, and apparently the whole tour had been that bad. And so Andy White said to John McIver, no, I'm going to do my own gigs, or I've got another series of shows or whatever it is. No, I won't do it. And they must have needed somebody, because he turned around to me and said, do you want to do it, Wes? And I was like, yep. So I was in my first year of doing a PhD at Cambridge, and I just kind of left. I wasn't doing very much work anyway. And I went on tour with the Hot House Flowers, kind of honed my live act, in as much as you can call playing for 35 minutes to an audience who've never heard of you a live act, and got a record deal by the end of it with Demon Records. And so that was the beginning of everything, really. That was 1988.
Okay.
I recorded a live album in November 88, which came out before Christmas or right at the beginning of 89. And then that same year, because I think Glenn felt that didn't really work, the first album, which was a live acoustic record, or that, you know, it hadn't made the splash he wanted it to make, he said, fuck England, you know, let's go and see somebody American and put your records out in America. I think you'll do maybe better there because they have long memories for the acoustic guitar. That was his theory.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did, and went up to his office, and I played him The Devil in Me. And he went, that sounds like a single, let's do that. And here's Andy Paley coming by the office in 2 hours. Hang on and meet him, he'll be your producer. And that was how it all began.
From Here Comes the Groom, John Wesley Harding's 1990 major label debut, this is The Devil in Me.
Shotgun at Kennedy in Dallas in 63. They blamed it on Oswald carelessly, but it was the devil in me. Put Jesus on the cross, I put a gag on the boss, I kicked him on the cheek so he could speak, but that was the devil in me. It was the devil in me. It was the devil in me. Well, it's the devil. Sheets on the bed, I made you cry, could have made you laugh instead, but that was the devil in me. So I killed you off, I saw your famous brown fur coat, I laughed at your cough, ignored your suicide note, but that was the devil in me.
On your first couple studio albums, you used Bruce and Pete Thomas of The Attractions.
Yep.
And it seems like there was this sort of backlash, particularly in certain British music papers with a history of lazy journalism, that you were this Elvis Costello sound-alike.
Well, that's nice of you to say lazy journalism. I would say it was extremely lazy journalism. But, you know, I'm me. And the fact is, they were local guys, drinking friends of mine. And my managers, I should say, they weren't my friends, they were his friends. But, you know, they were all part of the scene. And who wouldn't use them?
Right.
And I certainly wasn't trying to sound like Elvis Costello, although Elvis Costello's records up to Blood and Chocolate, they were really important records for me. Mm. I mean, 100%, definitely great records. I remember rushing out to buy Armed Forces, and I remember being crazy excited to find My Funny Valentine as the B-side of Oliver's Army. And, you know, I mean, those records were huge for me. But by the time I really made my records, that was all deep osmosis stuff, because I wasn't paying any attention to Mighty Like a Rose or none. I thought they were just terrible. I couldn't bear the way he sang with all the vibrato in his voice. He was the last thing I was thinking about. And I, you know, if you hear Here Comes the Groom, I admit that I didn't know what I was doing in a recording studio. Nothing. I knew nothing. I was taught how to hold a guitar still to play it into the microphone. I certainly had arranging ideas, like, oh, I'd like this solo to go a bit like this. But Andy Paley, the producer, and Mark Lynette, the engineer, taught me everything I know, purely because the only times I've been in recording studios before was demoing the songs with The Attractions in a rehearsal room with a 4 or 8 track or whatever that we barely knew how to use. And it was more or less true with the second album. The first album I really felt I knew what I was doing in a recording studio was when we made John Mazzucato Harding's New Deal, which was my 4th or 5th album. What I've always done when I'm in a recording studio is gone, I need this bit to go like this, and this bit shouldn't go ba ba da ba da ba ba. It should go ba ba. You know, I have very firm ideas. It doesn't mean I've ever been able to turn on a piece of recording equipment, but I know what instruments I kind of want to do what. And even recently, when I go in with the Jayhawks, it's like, bass and drums, get your part together. Not my concern. You're great. Do it. Then I might tweak a little thing here and there, but the rest I'm actually quite certain about, because it's just the way I've heard it all in my head and I want it to be out there. Well, when I was making those records with The Attractions, anything that's attraction-y about them, except the sound of my own voice, is completely the work of the two people playing it from The Attractions, not to mention Kenny Craddock, RIP, the great Hammond organ and piano player, very, very good friend of mine from Hastings, who was in Lindisfarne and played with Van Morrison. What a genius, died so sadly. And Steve Donnelly on the lead guitar. Anything that's attractions-y about that album is to do with Andy Paley's production, and I loved it all because I was new and excited and, you know, it was all great. And then whatever is in my voice that is Elvis Costello-y, which is an effect, by which I don't mean an affectation, but which is the result of him being one of my 20 or 30 absolute favorite artists when I was in my early teenage.
Sure.
And I can't speak to that. If I sound just like Elvis Costello, or I did on those two records, or now, whatever, then, I mean, I completely cop to that. But those records were not made in any cynical way to sound like him. But, of course, they did have the added coincidence of having 2/3 of his backing band, whom he was not using at the time, on them, which to me was an incredible excitement and honor to have Pete and Bruce playing on those albums. I mean, what could be better than that? I didn't really know they would play on somebody else's record. It just never occurred to me. I remember meeting Steve Lillywhite at a party. I was kind of friends with Curtis McCall, who'd sung on that first record, actually, but songs that were recorded at Tom Robinson. He was an incredibly important mentor for me in those early days. He had me open for him, taught me a lot about how to do a live show. Great, great guy. But I met Steve Lillywhite at a party, and somebody said, oh, Steve, and it was just so, he was like, I just don't understand why you would want to copy Elvis Costello so exactly. I'd never met him. And I was like, A, that's friendly. And I don't know whether he's the friendliest bloke in the world. I know nothing about him. I've never met him before or since. I've certainly been in his house a couple of times. And I remember thinking then, it was before the album had come out. And I remember thinking, oh, God, I wonder if that's going to be a problem. I mean, you can imagine that somebody smarter than me or more self-conscious than me or with a cleverer manager than I had might well have gone, oh, this could be tactically bad. But we didn't do that. We just were like, fuck, chance to make a record, go.
From 1991's The Name Above the Title, his second album on Sire Records, here's a song called Backing Out.
Been living in the city too long now. Even my lungs have started to groan. Everybody is singing their own song. Sometimes I wanna sing alone. Never been a prima donna. I never seem to wanna be the one to complain. Enough's too much and now I'm gonna stop the madness soon before it drives me insane. Take away the sun won't shine on me. Take away my conscience won't go now. Take away the sun won't shine on me. Don't tell me I'm backing out cause I don't wanna know. Don't tell me I'm backing out cause I don't wanna know. This town is so angry now. Blaring horns and swearing, shaking fists. If everybody in the world was a hitman, we'd wipe each other off each other's hit lists. Who wants to stand and be counted? Or anger ever amounted to his lines on your face now. I don't wanna be the one to start the shouting. I'm part of the society, I know my place. Take me where the sun won't shine on me. Take me where my conscience won't go now. Take me where the sun won't shine on me. Don't tell me I'm backing out cause I don't wanna know. Don't tell me I'm backing out cause I don't wanna know. Everything around this town is so boring. Well, nothing changes, nothing doesn't stay the same. 10 years ago when we had high ideals, we couldn't wait to play the protest game. But now we have our thing together, our brand new leather three bank accounts. Who cares about the starving millions? We're just so happy that our checks don't bounce. Take me where the sun won't shine on me. Take me where my conscience won't go now. Take me where the sun won't shine.
I do not for a moment regret any of Elvis Costello stuff at all, because I could only make the records that I was able to make at the time, and those were the ones that I at that time could make. I'm not the kind of person who massively plans out strategies of my career, which is why my career is exactly the way that it is, and why I'm probably a fairly happy person, because I've never put myself up for huge failure in any way, because I don't like the stakes to be high. I like the stakes to be low, and I like everything to be fun. I read a great Martin Short quote the other day, who's a comedian I love, and he said, you can never really control the quality of the finished product or tell how things will turn out. So you learn very early on that the hang has got to be fun. And that is absolutely the philosophy of my career. Every situation I've been in, whether it be with Steve Berlin in a basement in LA, or with the Jayhawks in Minneapolis more recently, or with the Decemberists in Portland more recently, or with the Minus Five more recently, or with my band the English UK in Philly at Milk Boy recently, and every Cabinet of Wonders where I am the MC and the putter together of the show, and where I like everyone to be really comfortable. So the show feels like a kind of a Dick Cavett show,
yeah,
where everything's in control, everything's relaxed, you're welcome, it's going to be a nice time for everyone. And that is exactly the philosophy of all those things. I don't know how this is going to turn out, but I really trust the process. I've always trusted the process. I've always gone, this is the album I'm going to make. Let's have some fun. In my experience, it's better to wholeheartedly grasp opportunities and have as much fun with them as you possibly can. And I believe, I mean, given that I've been making records for 30 years, I'd have to conclude that that philosophy was successful for me, on some level anyway.
Did you feel that Sire was a good fit? And to what extent did you benefit from the backing of the major label system?
Well, you know, things were very, very different then. And I'm really towards the last generation of people who were even part of that system at all. Like, I'm not sure even 5 or 10 years later if anybody would have... I mean, I still have the same publishing deal with the same publishing company that I got in 1987. And they take money off me. You know, they take a sizable percentage of everything I do. But on the other hand, they have always paid or thrown money into the pot for my records to be made. Arguably, that's how I've continued to be a recording artist. So I was never quite... Although I was on Demon Records and on many other indie records over the years, I essentially started off in the very old-fashioned major label paradigm where, you know, you put out one record and they hoped it was good and it got some good reviews. And then the second record, they hoped for a real improvement. And if the third record didn't happen, then maybe that was it for you. But there was a real kind of system of it. And I was on the radio the other day with a DJ I like, and he said, what about, you know, Nirvana? And I was like, well, what do you mean about Nirvana? He said, well, they grunge totally changed everything in rock for people like you. You and your contemporary songwriters were going to be the next big wave of stuff. And then grunge happened and knocked all that out of the water because people completely changed their direction. And I mean, that had never occurred to me. I think there's a little sense in it when you think about it, but you just don't think of these things because I'm just living a life making albums. I don't consider myself part of any movement or wave or, you know, anything like that. Well, funnily enough, I didn't, and I do a little more now since I've been doing my Cabinet of Wonders shows because I kind of see where I fit in the network of people a bit more. But, you know, I've never been very self-conscious about those things. I was never part of shoegaze or, you know, I was just a singer-songwriter in the folky tradition.
Right.
So it was interesting being part of Sire. I mean, the only reason I even got to be on Sire was that that record, my record, was played to what was their alternative marketing department. Well, not the only reason, but here's a good story, and it's true. It's played to the alternative marketing department, who are rather a revolutionary department across WEA that dealt with the releases they liked on Sire and Reprise. So they were selling REM, Replacements, Ocean Blue, maybe Mighty Lemon, you know, whoever was on the time. I can't remember who all were those people. But we're dealing 89, 90. And somebody on that marketing team, when Howie Klein or whoever played them the record, said, yeah, we want to work that record. That's great. He's got Peter Case on one of the songs. We consider this alternative. Now, there was no real way that that record was an alternative record, but there was no particular other genre to put it in. So suddenly I found myself a kind of alternative artist, you know, vying for a slot on postmodern rock radio, college stations kind of thing. And because Americana and where that stuff, I mean, I talk about this stuff like I even know what I'm talking about. And frankly, I've never been an expert on any of this stuff. But Americana, you know, the people who play that stuff, that didn't come in for years after I started. Kind of roots. I mean, you know, people getting rootsy again and there being a kind of radio station that might play Wildflowers by Tom Petty. I mean, it would have been classic rock or nothing. But then there were all these other stations like XPN's a big one in Philly. I guess... you've got a big one, X something or other.
XRT?
XRT, of course. They were so nice to me in my early days in Chicago and created a whole audience for me in Chicago. Anyway, so I think I really did benefit from it because there was so much interest in the kind of people that were coming out under this WEA alternative marketing department. They had their own magazine, by which I don't mean a giveaway that you got chucked in your bag in Tower, but a magazine where they get people to write about stuff and do drawings and the releases and Jane's Addiction and who drew the cover, Martin Phillips from the Chills, and they put out all these singles. I did a Chills cover on one side and the Chills were on the other. So, you know, it was really cool and fun. It felt like whatever the big man could have fucked up with alternative music and however he commodified it all, it felt to me like an oasis and somewhere to be having some fun. I don't think they really ever A&R'd me terribly well, in as much as, you know, Andy Paley was a great guy and a super great producer, and we did two albums pretty quick, more or less the same, but the second one had horns. And then the third album, I made an album with Steve Berlin, which was an album I was very proud of, and then that was it. You know, I was curtains there. Because they were all changing, and Seymour was kind of out by then, and it all got folded in, and my friend Harry Klein said, you might want to go on another label. And then I did take a very indie path for a little while and had an album out on Rhino that I loved and made very acoustic-y. Then there was another label called Zero Hour, and before I ended up back on oddly on a major label with Hollywood Records. So the 90s were kind of the paradigm of what was happening to rock music altogether, probably.
Up next, we'll hear a song from an album intended for release in 2002 as The Man With No Shadow on the Disney-affiliated label Mammoth Records, which folded days before the album was set to come out. The album eventually surfaced 2 years later as Adam's Apple, from which we'll hear a song called Monkey and His Cat.
Monkey keeps his cat up in a cage upon the stage, and the crowned heads of Europe cheer the wonder of the age. 'Cause the cat's just like a bird, and good old monkey grinds the tune, and the cat will dance fandangos just above the footlight moon. Then he'll make a very bird-like sound. Monkey makes him flop upon the ground as though he's flying. Some people think he's dying. Man got his monkey. Monkey got his cat. Cat got his flea. Flea's got me. Everybody's free to work on their act. Monkey and his cat. At monkeys, he melts all the applause. Above the clanker change that ricochets across the floor. Monkey says, I love you, and returns into the cage. Bows to all the ladies and then exits from the stage. The cat is dressed up as a puss in boots. Monkey wears a sparkling new suit just like a human. All the girls are swooning. Man got his monkey. Monkey got his cat. Cat got his flea. Flea's got me. Everybody's free to work on their act. Monkey and his cat. Get his cat. Monkey and his cat retrieve the key and go within the humble home sweet home where they so quietly live in sin. Man will bring them supper as they sit before the fire. Once he was the grinder, now he has to work for hire. He didn't keep his finger on the pulse. The audience demanded something else, a new distraction. Some cat and monkey action. Man got his monkey. Monkey got his cat. Got his flea, flea's got me. Everybody's free to work on their act. Monkey and his cat.
monkey and his cat.
These days, there are a few examples of popular musicians who have written novels without them being received as a dalliance by a dilettante.
Very few people have had that honor.
Did you use your given name as a way of pushing back against that perception?
Yes. There were two things, really. Firstly, I am not a household name the size of... Well, who can we... In fact, the biggest people who've written novels, like Jimmy Buffett and Kinky Friedman, because they're genre novels, have gotten away very easily and had bestsellers with, how would you describe it, fiction that is an extension of their brand. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And in genres, right? In detective fiction and that kind of thing. Right. Well, that's one kind of thing. But going for a literary novel, which I'm, you know, not ashamed to say I was and have four times now, I felt that although I wasn't a household name, it would be more interesting for me to write a great novel or a good novel even and have people find out that I put out a bunch of records than to see that name, John Wesley Harding. That name is a bespoke pseudonym for an acoustic guitar playing songwriter, and it builds on levels of knowledge of Bob Dylan. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's not a good name to see on the side of a novel set in the 1800s or the 1900s, which my first novel was. It was a large slice of Dickensiana, basically, my first novel.
It would be an anachronism.
It would be, yes. It would be a pseudonymic anachronism. And I didn't like the idea of my fans feeling, oh, we've got to follow this aspect. I just felt like it should all be a different thing. I got a lot of kickback from the publishers, of course, because they just want to sell any amount of novels. And I had my agent say to them, and she was terribly supportive, say, we think this will be bigger than his music. You know, we think that it'll be people reading this book going out to buy his music, not the other way around. And that was kind of her line on it. And I think that proved to be the right idea because it was well reviewed. It came out all over the place. And, you know, and then I wrote another one and then another one and then another one. And now I'm writing another one. So it's an ongoing thing. But what it did mean eventually was that it just got too fucking boring being introduced as John Wesley Harding and Wesley Stater. And at some point, much to the kind of distress of really of the people booking my gigs and... the poor people who have to actually release these records, which I'm so grateful that they do. And I was just like, fuck it. I'm just going to use Wesley Stace from now on. I can only have one name. It's just too lengthy. The whole process is too lengthy.
Right.
But it's not like I have a particular, you know, people, artists, if they change their name like that, there's two ways to do it. You either have to be stern about it and go, no, he will only be called, you know,
the symbol
from now on. He will only be called. Or you do a kind of more of a Bonnie Prince Billy thing where you're just like, yeah, you can call me any of them. It doesn't really matter. You know, whatever the project is, I'm not going to fine you if you get it wrong on the poster, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And mine is definitely much more the latter. I mean, there's still people who say, oh, do you mind if we say John Wesley Harding? I'm like, no, it's fine. Provided you know I go by Wesley Stace now. It was sad in a way. It was annoying in a way, sad, because that album I made, self-titled, the first Wesley Stace album, that's the best album I'll ever make in my life in terms of just the clarity of the message and the niceness of the simplicity of the production and the lack of cymbals on it. And I really, that might seem a bit dour to other people, but to me that was such a cool record. I was so pleased I made it exactly the way that I did. And yet, because that was the crossover album to Wesley Stace, you know, it didn't quite get the attention from people that I'd hoped it would. But, you know, I've only myself to blame for that. That was why the next one I had both Wesley Stace and John Wesley Harding in the title.
Right.
So if I've got them in the title, people can't get away from it. I'm sure that was very annoying to people, too.
Here's the opening track from Wesley Stace's 2013 self-titled album called The Dealer's Daughter.
I loved the dealer's daughter, but there was a price attached. thought she was beautiful. I knew there'd be a catch. She was so secretive. She served her father well. I loved the dealer's daughter, so I joined her clientele. I loved the dealer's daughter, but I knew I couldn't win. Giving up that girl was just like kicking heroin. When I thought that I was done, I'd be running back for more. But I loved the dealer's daughter, and she taught me how to score. Smoked her cigarettes, overstayed my welcome, and I couldn't clear my debts. There was no future left, for both of us were safe. I loved the dealer's daughter, and she wrote that on my grave. I loved the dealer's daughter, and she wrote that on my grave.
So I guess that brings us up to the present and future. You've mentioned you're working on a new novel. You've mentioned you're working on writing new songs. I read that Wonder Kid was optioned to be a sitcom.
That went south.
Oh, okay.
As the, you know, these things are, many things are optioned.
Mm-hmm.
What's that phrase? Many are chosen. You know, many are something, few are chosen.
Sure.
It's like I've had many, many options in my life. In fact, the most recent option is Miss Fortune has just been optioned to be turned into a TV series. Well, it's nice these people have positive ideas about these things. Isaac Mizrahi optioned Jessold, my third novel, to be made into a movie, and that lasted 2 years. That didn't get made either. I mean, it's got to be optioned to take it off the table so nobody else can do it.
Sure.
But it doesn't necessarily mean anything will happen. But there's always a lot of things going on, and some of them are glamorous things like that, and some of them are less glamorous things, like I'm teaching at Swarthmore this year, you know. But to me, that is an incredibly satisfying thing too, and I really like doing it. So there's always a lot going on, but the key things for me this year are a bunch of Cabinets of Wonder, producing a record for my friend David Lewis in April at Daniel Smith from the Danielson Family Studio. Then the Straub's 50th anniversary in April, which is going to be great.
Mm.
And there, which I'm in the Straub's for, it's a long story, but Grave New World, I'm playing in the band for that. And then putting together a kind of tribute to the Straub's less well-known songs as part of it, with a lot of different singers, including people, you know, lots of people I love, basically, and who like the Straub's. And then writing all year. And coalescing plans for an album, which I would think I might try and make in the fall. And then the big thing that I've just been handed in is that I have co-authored with the choreographer, Mark Morris, his memoir, which is coming out on my birthday this year in October. And that's been a really fun, very rewarding project with a good friend of mine. I suggested to him, actually, is the truth of it, that he should do it. And he said, I'll do it if you do it. And I thought, oh, yep, I've walked into that one. And that's right, that I should be the person to do it.
Mm.
And it's literally, the book's just been copy edited, and it'll be going and out to, not printing, but, you know, the kind of advanced reading copies of it will be being put together very shortly. And then it comes out October 22nd. So that's a, I'm not sure how much I'll have to do for the rest of the process, including when it's published, but it was a very satisfying thing to get done and deliver.
Mm.
There's a lot of things happening for me this year, but they're kind of things I've done already coming out.
Mm.
There's a single coming out in March or April, and then there's a reissue of my album, The Man With No Shadow, coming out later this year, that was the album that finally came out as Adam's Apple, that was easily my best sounding album ever. And so we're going to do a vinyl and CD reissue, but in the original state that it was meant to be put out in before it was shelved for a year and a half and came out on another label.
Okay.
So there's a bunch of stuff, but it's all stuff I've done. So that makes it a terrific year for me to do some gigs, make a record, write a novel, and do the things that won't come out for another year or two. So it's definitely time to start thinking about another record, but I've decided, which I've never done before in my career, that I'm going to write all the songs specifically for it.
Okay.
Normally I have loads of songs lying around, always leftovers, and oftentimes when I make an album, I'll pick six and then use four or five old ones and six new ones and then write a couple in the last week. But this one, I just want to write songs all of a particular type, don't know what type, and have them be a record. And I've never done that before, so I'm kind of excited about it. But I don't know what it's going to be yet or who I'm going to make it with.
Well, I'm excited either way.
Thank you.
Here's a track from Wesley Stace's John Wesley Harding, an album released in 2017 featuring backing by the Jayhawks, called Let's Evaporate.
Wet clothes on the laundry line, a couple of hours and they'll be dry. There's no need to wait, let's evaporate. Glass of vodka overnight, half gone in the morning light. I give in to fate, let's evaporate. We are water, you and me, turning into air, falling back down to the earth. Who knows where? Robbed the wine dark sea, all that's left is salt and leaves. Before it gets too late, let's evaporate. We are vapor, you and me, a disappearing act, rising in the atmosphere and falling back. We're climbing in the atmosphere and falling back. Let's evaporate. I give in to fate. Let's evaporate. Let's evaporate.
And that's all the time we have for this week's episode. I'd like to thank Wes for taking the time to speak with Stereo Hysteria. And if you're in the New York City area, tickets are available now for the February and March installments of Wesley Stace's Cabinet of Wonders at the City Winery. More information about those shows can be viewed at cabinetofwonders.com. And for further information about his musical and literary pursuits, head over to wesleystace.com. Be sure to tune in again next week when we'll be hearing a set of songs about ghosts. This is Charlie. Signing off.